Welcome to Indie Thinker with Reed Huberman. You're about to make the jump from the dishonest mainstream media into free and independent thought from key thought leaders on the subjects of culture, causes, politics, and faith. Welcome to Indie Thinker. I'm Reed Huberman, and we have an amazing show planned for you today with a great guest that I cannot wait for you to hear from. But before we jump into that, I want to take just a moment to share with you about Indie Thinker and what we're trying to accomplish here. Indie Thinker is a podcast that's an hour long each episode and will showcase a different guest each week. Each week, we'll bring on a guest that will share something about politics, causes, culture, or faith in the intersection between those subjects in a way that I think will be really, really uplifting, inspirational, and certainly educational for each and every one of us. We believe that the cure for greater and more freer thinking in our society is truly through conversation. We can no longer allow the mainstream media to do our thinking for us. We have to start breaking free from those confines and start searching for information in alternative sources. And so, Indie Thinker is a place where you can come to hear great guests on fantastic subjects that will open your mind to a vast array of different ideas. We want to create conversations that will make a difference in our community, and we want to give you the opportunity to think better than you did before you watched each episode. Thanks so much for tuning in, and enjoy the rest of the show. Kevin Brooks, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been something I've been looking forward to doing for a while.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So just a little bit of background, and then we'll jump into some loftier topics. But so you are a mayor and a former state rep. So tell me kind of your journey from, because forgive me if I'm wrong about this, but I think you originally went kind of in more of a religious path, working for a denomination, the Church of God, and then you went on a political path. So we're just going to today on this podcast absolutely drop a nuke on the taboo of never talking about politics and faith.
Yeah.
But I am interested about your transition from kind of that route of working with a religious institution and then moving into politics.
Right. You know, thanks very much, first of all, for having me. I do not believe, nor is it in the Constitution, about the separation of church and state. That was a letter that was written about a group in France, and it has no constitutional bearing, although we've had court rulings in its favor. It is actually not part of our Constitution. So the whole question of separation of church and state, I actually have a great example. The church doesn't like me to do political business on their phone, 501c3. So this is my political phone, and this is my church phone. So this is the only separation of church and state that I've got. Very true story. Really have always had a life of public service. I inherited that gene. The earliest memories of my dad are serving. I have childhood memories of him at a men's retreat with a golf towel in his hand, cleaning and serving as the golfers returned. I was too young to participate, but I was there as his son. You know, what do you do with your kid? You bring him with you. Back in those days, we didn't have sitters and nannies and all that sort of thing. And so I have this mental image of my dad always serving. To this day, he's 80 years old and still cooks for the church and still makes, you know, hams for Christmas at this time of year. He's always had that service. I inherited that from him. Really early on, you know, Christian school, same as my wife. We met at Cobb Christian School outside of Atlanta. I ran for class president. I mean, I was always politically inclined because, like being born in the 60s, you hear the Kennedy mantra of service and the call to serve and the honor of service. And so that was where I fit in the best and came to Lee, our church school, and graduated and served in student government the whole time I was at Lee, worked for the president. Dr. Kahn. And so I was sort of in these political circles. We came to city council a lot and became full-time staff And never in my wildest dreams, Reed, did I ever imagine being asked to go work at the Church of God headquarters. That's where all the old guys worked. And in fact, when the general overseer sent word to me via his administrative liaison at church one night, you and I both attended North Cleveland, and we were in the fellowship hall in the hallway, and this guy walked up to me and said, "Kevin, general overseer would like to meet with you." And I said, "Well, Kevin Kelly's office is down the hall." Happened all the time. People handed me money for his CDs. I wasn't Kevin Kelly. He was on staff at the time at the church. And he goes, no, we want to talk to you. And I was like, what did I do wrong? And offer me the job in public relations. And I've been there. This is my 16th year. Very fortunate to be in such a great role. Because I tell people, I probably would not have had the ability to run for office if I had not made that move to the headquarters building. They were incredibly supportive of a church member being active in that arena. You may have heard of the seven mountaintops. One of those is government, and it's actually rare. There's not many of us who serve in public office and also serve in a church role. Even fewer of us are Pentecostal politicians, which is a pretty small subgroup. And so I'm thrilled that more and more people of faith, we now have school board members that are Lee professors. We have city council members who are Lee professors. To me, I think the absence of people of faith in the government marketplace is the problem. We are in a very difficult place right now in our nation.
Yeah.
And I think the founding fathers had a different take on it. They were very comfortable with their faith, wrote about it, are endowed by our Creator. This language was very common, and somehow we've gotten away from that. That's not what this podcast is about, but that's my story, is that I believe people of faith not having their voice heard. We talked about voice a minute ago, and being able to be that voice in the political arena, whether it's in Nashville, whether it's in Cleveland as mayor, my faith and my service are intertwined.
Yeah, I love that, because we're going to get in the weeds now. Here's a deep philosophical statement, if I do say so myself. I think the absence of faith in these arenas, as I joked earlier, right, that two things you don't talk about, politics and faith. Okay, so we've absolutely extricated the most important conversation that we can have in our lifetime, the conversation of faith, from the public arena, from the public circle. Now, in some ways, I think Christianity has a lot to own up to in terms of how that took place. But in the aftermath of it, regardless of how it took place, is especially in the political arena. And I'd love to hear what you have to say about this, since not only have you dealt with politics on a state and local level, but also on a grander scale, state level, and then probably some intermingling on the federal. But what's happened in the aftermath of a post-Christian nation is that we've also evolved politically in a very strange way. God is no longer certainly the center, or even morality the center of our politics, and as a result of it, what's taken its place is a new kind of religion, I think. A kind of woke religion where now the last people on the planet that may actually believe in science are actually Christians. And while Democrats claim to be the party of science, believe in incredibly unscientific views as it pertains to gender and all sorts of other stuff. And so without digging into the weeds too much, I think what I see anyway is a post-Christian government that now we say, okay, separation of church and state. Okay, well, that's one layer. We're next layer removed. We're now... there's a radicalness to our political life and to some political ideology that's taking this country in a very, very strange turn, to say the least. Now, I'd just love to hear maybe kind of any of your musings on that.
Sure. You know, and you're exactly right. I mean, the pendulum has swung in such a vast direction. You're either right, radical, Christian, or you're left far liberal Democrat.
I know I'm not that, yeah. So I guess I'm that. Well,
the thing is, though, there used to be a bunch of us right down here in the middle. As a matter of fact, part of the criticism that I received in Nashville for those 12 years that I was there was I got along great with three governors that I served. Phil Bredesen, although we did not philosophically align or politically align, were both incredibly fiscally conservative. I served on finance, and he would, you know, sort of wag his finger at me and, you know, you Republicans who say you're conservatives, I'm more conservative than you are. Mm. And this was coming.
And what was Phil's role?
Governor okay. Bredesen. And so Governor Haslam was elected in 2010, very good friends with Governor.
He's a Democrat?
Republican.
Okay.
Part of the Republican majority, which then became the supermajority. And then Governor Lee was elected. I'm still very good friends with Governor Lee. But part of the criticism was, you know, Kevin is a moderate because he's friends with the Democrats. And I would say, no, I am friends with that man because God calls me to be that man.
Yeah.
And that friend. That comes first. And no, we don't agree politically, but spiritually, I am commanded to love thy neighbor as thyself.
Yeah.
And so again, 12 years in Nashville, 2 years now as mayor, I still get asked, so what's next? What do you want to run for next? And my answer is never, ever published because it's always been the same. Whatever God opens, whatever God wills for me to do, that's what I'm going to do. And they, you know, look at you quizzically like, do you hear a voice? Do you... I say, well,
yeah. I got machinations of Mike Pence.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
You hear from the man upstairs.
So it's this, you know, whatever door God opens for me to serve in that capacity, I believe, and that sort of lends itself to a whole different philosophical conversation of elections. We talked about that a minute ago. And, you know, God channels the hearts of the king. There's plenty of verses that talk about promotion comes from the Lord. And I believe that my time in Nashville had come to a close, and that it was time for me to serve here. Little bit of a backstory. Mayor Emeritus Rowland, who served for 28 incredible years, actually asked me to consider it in 2016. And I, in my carnal thinking, things are going great in Nashville, and I'm vice chairman of finance, and I finally figured out the Da Vinci Code of how to get things for the Cleveland State and the Veterans Home and Exit 20, and it's taken me 10 years to get here. Now's not the time. Be careful when you say, God, you lead me, because when he does lead you and you don't do it, those were two of the most difficult years. I mentioned being categorized as a moderate. I ran for a leadership position within my own caucus, and it was very badly lost because I was not where I was supposed to be when I was supposed to be there. Realized and called back and actually met Mayor Emeritus Rowland in a dry cleaner parking lot. And I said, with tears in my eyes, I think I may have missed what I'm supposed to be doing. Are you still interested in not being mayor and me coming home and retiring? Because you can't be both. You can't serve in Nashville and serve here. So I had to literally resign from my position there and run for this office. And it was a wonderful sort of rekindling of our both relationship and my personal walk, because now I'm without a doubt doing exactly what God wants me to do and serving in my hometown in a capacity that I never really saw myself, but can't imagine not doing this.
And so I really do want to talk about this. So I'm sure there's much more we could say about that. But so you came home to Cleveland, which is a city just outside of Chattanooga, for those who are listening and don't know or watching. And so now you're the mayor of Cleveland. And so you come home and you're serving now at probably what is one of the most trying times for anybody in any political office. And if that wasn't enough, then you get COVID.
Yeah.
So my wife has been beating me up, telling me all the things I have to ask you about COVID because she was so touched by your story. So I would really just love to hear about your experience there with that. And I'll give you my little anecdotal experience. So about 2 weeks ago, my 82-year-old father-in-law is coming up for Christmas and with us. My wife starts feeling a little sick, gets a little bit sicker the next day, and immediately we say, oh boy, not only do me and the kids in the house, but now we've got her elderly parents in the house. And so we quarantine her in the room. We do the whole nasal swab, touching your brain with the Q-tip, fast rapid COVID test, and just try to figure out what's going on. And all of it comes back negative. And then my wife, the next couple of days, starts to feel better. And it was just a sinus infection. So in that little period of time, we recognized what is like hell 2 weeks when people have to go in quarantine. Now, it was only a couple days for us, but in that little amount of time, I started to get a glimpse of what it must have been like for people like you and other people who have gotten COVID. So I'd just love to hear about your experience, what it was like to kind of be holed up in a room for 2 weeks and then be in your house and not be able to like have contact with your wife and stuff, because you really don't understand that until you have to go through it. So I'd love to hear about it.
So I'm thrilled that your wife only has the sinus infection and it wasn't anything more serious. But, you know, when I came in, I had my mask on and I tell people, you know, I am the guy 2 years ago, 2018, my first act as mayor, my first purchase order was hand sanitizers. We have them at headquarters, Church of God headquarters. And I said, hey, Melinda, come over here and get the serial number off those. I want four. I want one at the door. I want one outside the mayor's office, one inside the city hall chamber, and you put the other one wherever you want.
What motivated that? Is that just general cleanliness?
That's just me. I kept Purell in business before COVID.
Okay.
I'm that guy. I shake hands. I hug voters. I kiss babies. I constantly, my mom sells that those essential oils, and there's one called Thieves. She sends it to me by the box. There's a spray that you can put in, spray it in your mouth. It's crazy. There's a hand sanitizer. I get all of this stuff.
It is over the top. But I got to say that the most over the top thing is like, if you don't live in Tennessee, then you should know that some of the babies in Tennessee are not kissable. But so anyway,
that's true. That's very true. But when you're the mayor, everybody wants you to shake your hand and say hi to you. So that was 2018. We progress into 2020. I'm like, aren't y'all glad I got those hand sanitizers? I was the guy who thought he was doing everything right. Lots of social distancing. We were the first city in our region, in our area, to stop giving out city permits for big events. We did that very early. I got criticized for it. Oh, Brooks, you're going to kill us. You're going to shut down our city. No, we got to do all we can to keep everybody safe. Stopped having city council meetings in person, many, many steps that we took. And then I started feeling bad. Couldn't figure it out. I have only had kidney stones once in my life. Please God, never let me have them again. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was a kidney stone. My back was hurting. And I said, as every Tennessee husband, honey, could you run over to Dollar General and see if you can see if they can get some cranberry juice? Because I was thinking, okay, I just got to get this out. And my lower back was killing me. And that was on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, no better. I said, hey, babe, got any more of that cranberry juice? She goes, honey, you drank all of it. I was dehydrated. I was feverish. Lots of unpleasant, unspeakable problems. And by Saturday, really didn't feel like getting up, going around. By Sunday, I was incapacitated. I remember how difficult it was. I had isolated myself upstairs by that time. And I remember how difficult it was just moving from the couch to the bed. Forget getting up and going to the bathroom. But I was so dehydrated, it didn't matter. So by Monday, Kim said, we got to get you tested. Something's wrong. So we do the, much like you probably did, you do the drive through and you get the nasal thing. And I had been tested a lot. I think before, simply because I'm mayor, I had lunch with somebody. Oh, they tested positive. You need to go get checked. I think I had been tested 8 times prior to my hospitalization. All negative. The day Monday of being that sick, negative for COVID. I said, I feel like I've been hit by a truck. Negative for flu, negative for strep. They were testing me for everything because I felt so bad. And she goes, I kind of hear something rattling around in your lungs, but we're outside in the tent, the triage in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. And she goes, I think I hear something. I'm going to give you a Z-Pack and a breathalyzer.
Nebulizer.
Yeah. Breathalyzer. Different show.
Let's put that on social
media. And a nebulizer and a Z-Pack. And, you know, if you don't get better, you probably need to go to the hospital. The next morning, couldn't get out of bed.
So you never even had a positive test?
No, never. And so my daughter, who's a nurse at Vanderbilt in Nashville, said, Mom, if you don't take him to the hospital, I'm going to drive home and I'm going to take him. He's sick. So Tuesday, this is the height of COVID. No visitors, no anything. Kim has to literally say goodbye in the parking lot because you go into ER and your family can't go with you. And, you know, so we packed a little bag. But I kept saying, you know, they're going to check me out. I'm going to come on home. Kim, be ready because I'm coming home. And I remember when the ER nurse, trauma nurse said, Mr. Brooks, you're not going anywhere. Your initial x-rays are very, very bad. And we're going to actually take you and get a CT. And so the CT scans proved double pneumonia, both lungs, bilateral is what they call it. And that can kill you. Bilateral pneumonia, double pneumonia can kill you by itself. But the infection specialist said, but you've got COVID. Your CT scans are what we hold up to see what COVID looks like. Yeah. Broken glass and all the things that they talk about. Tuesday, tested me for COVID in the hospital, came back negative. Came back negative on Wednesday, test me again on Thursday, negative again, test me again, comes back on Friday, test me again on Saturday. It wasn't until the third test that it was a definitive positive, which is why up to that point, I'm on what they call the PUI floor, people under investigation. Mm-hmm. You're not even on the COVID floor because you don't have COVID yet, although they suspected it heavily. Sicker, very, very sick. By the Saturday test, I had gotten so sick that they, late in the middle of the night, moved me to ICU. Sunday becomes my first day of ICU. And then 6 more days in ICU. And I'm so thankful that I was never on a ventilator. It got to the oxygen that comes out of the wall, it goes up to 10, and I was up to 8, which meant if I had gone 2 more notches of the need for oxygen, I would have been put on a thermo vent and then a ventilator. But I'm grateful because many of my friends were put on thermo vents and ventilators, and many of my friends did not survive. And so during that 11 days of hospitalization and then the 30 days of staying at home after I was dismissed, you realize what people aren't talking about. We're all focused on the symptoms and the physical. Fever, body aches, can't breathe. No one's talking about the psychological.
Yeah. By the way, side note, I was speaking with a police officer the other day in Chattanooga, and he said 60% of the calls that they had, and I'm sure you can probably testify speaking to your own force, 60% of the calls they had are all related to mental illness.
100%. I mean, we have a skyrocketing number of overdoses and depression and unfortunately suicides. Sadly, abuse is up. Both child abuse and spousal abuse, So all of that has to do with being locked in your house and the mental toll that this is taking on our children. I see it in grade school children who miss their friends. And then you take it to a guy in his 50s who is not in any way an introvert.
Yeah, I'm
an extrovert and I'm a people person. So to be isolated, there's one thing about being sick in a bed, you don't really care. But after the fifth or sixth day, I was feeling better and I was ready to go.
We'll get back to our guest in just a moment, but now it's time for Inconceivable.
Inconceivable!
Inconceivable is a segment in the show where we like to take a look at things that are in the news right now and poke a little fun at them. So whenever the news media parades around as journalists, we'll take a look at those news stories and have a little fun at their expense. So as you might imagine, there is no lack of content here. So today, since Christmas is right around the corner, we have a very special Christmas Inconceivable plan for you. Check it out right now.
Oh, hi there. Don't you just love this time of year? Around Christmas time, we remember so much. We remember family and friends. We remember the gifts nestled gently under our trees. Around this time, we are also reminded of one of the most important moments in history. You guessed it. We're taken back in time to a little town where the savior of the Democratic Party was born. And with one simple swipe, you too can go on Twitter and be condescendingly reminded of that simple little bar where AOC, the darling of the Democratic Party, got her start. In fact, I've got a little book right here that tells that very story of how she came to be. In fact, I have a great idea. Why don't we read it together? It was Barside where she saw the evils of toxic male masculinity, when men would have the audacity to ask for her number. At those times, she learned to stand up against benign overtures that are really quite innocent. Ah, sticking it to the man really hits the spot. It was there in that humble bar where she learned to tax the rich by charging wealthy hedge fund managers whatever she wanted, if only they got tipsy enough. It's funny how economics works. It was there in the dark corners of that bar where she learned that identity was malleable. Why, when 17 and 18-year-olds would come in with fake IDs to buy booze, it dawned on her, why not let anybody be anything they wanted to be with just the snap of a finger? Social justice never tasted so good. Nestled inside a busy bar was a walk-in fridge where many a tear was shed because seltzer water was given to a patron instead of sparkling water. Why, it was there where she realized we must put an end to consumerism by creating the Green New Deal. Surely that would put a stop to anyone ever buying anything ever again. The end. Wasn't that a great story? I hope and pray that this year, that story will bring as much laughter and cheer to you as it did to me. Merry Christmas. And now, back to the show.
It's one thing to listen to the news media and to even listen to politicians, but it's different to listen to somebody who's been there, done that. So I was speaking with somebody earlier today, too, about minority communities and issues facing the Black community. And it's just like, we hear all the time from the elitist media that has no idea what's going on in the inner city about what's going on in the Black community. So it's good to hear from people who have been there. So I want to talk to you about the residual effects of COVID and the psychological effects of COVID, because I really do think that you're onto something there. So a couple of things. I don't know if it's still this way, but the suicide rate in California was higher than the COVID death rate up as far as early as about, from the recording of this podcast, about 2 months ago or so. I don't know if that's changed or not, and it may have, but I've been concerned with the residual effects. And so, forgive me, but I got to bring this up. Just recently, we hear Mayor Cuomo get on an interview with Fauci. And he's supposed to be mayor of the year. And sorry, governor of the year, forgive me. And he's sitting there joking with Fauci about who wants to play Pacino and who wants to be Robert, or whether or not Pacino or De Niro is going to be one of them in the movie about their life. And this is the guy who sat there and stared at TV cameras and said that even if we save one life, we're going to lock down, with absolutely zero thought about the residual effects of COVID. Now, it's easy for me to say that because I haven't had COVID either. So, but I have been concerned with our political class saying that we're just going to shut everything down even if it saves one life. And then you have people like this girl whom I'm sure you've heard, the Pineapple Hill Saloon over in California, who's sitting there crying because essential workers, film crews, are able to do their thing in LA while her livelihood is being threatened every single day. And she's not able to run her restaurant in an outdoor setting. So it's just like there are residual effects to COVID. So now that you have dealt with it and that you've been on the front lines of COVID, you see how serious it is. And again, we're going to circle back to this. Could have taken your life. What do you think the balance is of policy right now with COVID? And where do you fall in lines in terms of quarantining, lockdown, and what that should look like so that the cure does not become worse than the disease?
You're exactly right. You're spot on. The cure cannot be worse than the mm-hmm. disease. Unilateral lockdowns are not the answer. So small town, Cleveland, Tennessee, small town mayor, part-time mayor, I hear it, if not daily, multiple times a week, when I go to a place to buy my shirts, when I go to the place to have breakfast, when I go to the place to get my haircut, mm-hmm. Mayor, please, you cannot shut us down. We will not survive. And this is not a random, isolated, very
yep.
small. This is 100% of the locally owned, especially businesses. So yeah. Here I am, the mayor who had COVID, and it shocked me how many people cared that I had COVID, but it was not just local media. I had statewide and in some cases national, twice actually. I was shocked that a mayor with COVID would even make national news, but it was followed up with, now that you've had COVID, don't yep. you think we should shut down? And why aren't you doing more of a mask mandate? And it was almost a shame on you. They were trying to shame me. Yeah, it was sick shaming. You've been sick. Shame on you for not doing more. I got one today on yeah. Facebook.
Yeah. So, well, I love that. I love the measured response there. And of course, when you get an Emmy or whatever for great television presence, you're interested in your appearance, so you're interested in ticket sales when you're on mainstream news media. And I don't know if you know what I'm referring to, but anyway, so you're interested in ticket sales, and so you don't hear measured responses. You hear audacious responses or radical responses because you know that that's probably what's going to get attention. And maybe it's totally 100% sincere, but I guess this is the one thing that I would just say, little old me, not that it matters, but I would just say that what we need is more measured responses coming from our political class, coming from people who are taking into account the very real effects of COVID outside of the physical effects of COVID. Because right now we're messing with something that's much bigger than hopefully what's about to be cured. By God's grace, we're going to have a vaccine, all that stuff, and people are going to start getting it. But we're messing with something, if we mess with our economy detrimentally, which we may have already, that is going to affect us for generations.
And yeah, there's no
and
doubt,
I'm concerned
no doubt.
About that.
You know, the generational wealth and the generational debt that we're dealing with, it's already into the trillions. It's already into your grandchildren's grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And people don't talk about that enough. People don't talk about what we're doing to the next generation. We have the conversation around the Brooks dinner table. Will our granddaughter ever remember, she's seven, will she ever remember a time when people didn't have to wear masks?
I know, yeah.
And you know, she's so cognizant of it, she calls it her COVID-19 mask, or no, coronavirus mask. And it's not just a face mask, it's her coronavirus mask. Yeah. And you realize a 7-year-old has the cognitive ability to identify it so specifically. Her friends, you know, she's isolated from her friends. She's someone in her class was positive. And so she herself isn't positive, but the whole class was quarantined. And what so then grade? You get in second.
Wow.
So then you get into the whole mom and dad are both working. So grandma and grandpa jump in and everybody's trying to share and take a day. And you realize the exponential problems of shutting down your schools, shutting down your businesses, shutting down your economy. This is going to sound ideological, but I don't care how much money they throw at you, how big your stimulus check is. Shutting down the economy is not the answer.
Yeah. Well, I'm a hypocrite because I was like, we're going to take this money and spend it. But I also know that there's an attachment to it. So, which is funny. We could talk all day long about that probably too, that all this like free money giving away idea. Yeah. It's like, it's coming from somewhere. It's not just that we have this print that makes money for us.
It's coming from you. That's your money.
So needless to say, I think that your response to all of that is so important for people to hear because of your experience with it, and then the measured response that you have along side of it. All right, so my wife will kill me if I don't ask you about the song.
True story.
It's Your Breath in Our Lungs. So it's a song I love. From the moment I heard it, was just taken to it. And so now it has a little bit of an extra special meaning to you. So forgive me, but I do not remember the artist of it.
It's Casting Crowns.
Okay.
And then there's two. I actually got in touch with the two songwriters out of Nashville. It's a man and woman. And Casting Crowns have
done
it.
Is it All Sons and Daughters?
It's All Sons and Daughters. So, and it's a man and a woman. Yeah. So it's a true story. So just like I told the media outlet, God healed me in room 107. There's an old Church of God song. I can take you to the time. I can take you to the place. And literally, room 107. I remember my wife and my family were outside. You're having to see them through the windows, and they were raising their hand towards my window in ICU. And I remember church gatherings and people from headquarters gathered, and there was a great exchange of faith. But I was still sick and getting better, but I was still very much in the throes of the difficulty breathing, and my oxygen was being monitored 24 hours a day. That's part of the ICU experience, is they just monitor you constantly. And so you have this people outside your window praying. My daughter, thankfully, she's much more tech savvy than I am. She found an app that people could send unlimited number of 30-second messages, and it would edit them and put them in a collage. And so I'm getting these messages of faith and messages of encouragement, going back to the psychological. Incredibly important if you've got a family member or a friend or just a person, a total stranger that you find out has COVID. Sending them a greeting and a message of encouragement is incredibly important. And I was getting these great messages from great men of faith and pastors from out of state, and it was helping and it was wonderful. But I still was struggling, still had the oxygen 24/7. And they ask you, and you may have seen this, they ask you to spend as much time on your stomach as possible. And there's a word for it, and I can't think of it right now, but they ask you to invert and lay on your stomach, lay on your chest. Something about that. There's actually photographs of people in ICU on a ventilator unconscious, and the nurses turn them over. There's something about the way that helps your lungs to clear. And so here I am on a heart monitor, and I have an IV. It was actually a direct port they put in because my IVs kept failing after 11 days. There's nothing left of your veins. So you're strapped in. You got all of this equipment, and they ask you to turn over. Are you kidding me? I remember turning over, And I remember just crying. I remember your body hurts. You can't breathe. All those euphemisms. I feel like an elephant sitting on my chest. I feel like there's, you know, all of that. I feel like a fish out of water. All of that is so true. You feel all of that. And I remember sitting up in frustration. And I remember looking out the window, and it was dark outside. So I believe it was pre-dawn. And I remember very clearly God revealing to me that just like Paul in prison, if I would sing, if I would praise him in the midst of this trial, he would heal me. And I remember very clearly the sacrifice of praise. Bring to me the sacrifice of praise. And Reed, I don't know about you, I don't remember the last time I heard that song or the last time I sang that song, but it was as clear to me as I am speaking to you right now. I heard the words, I heard the melody, I heard music, and I began to sing, "It's Your Breath in My Lungs." And I remember what stopped me was the beeping. And I remember clearly the beeping became so loud and so much faster. And it was my heart rate and it was my breathing. And my breathing, when I was in ER, they said was 79, which is terrible. It kept being in the 80s or low 90s. And she was like, "We got to get your breathing up. We got to get your breathing up." And I remember turning around and hearing the beeping, and my breathing had shot up to 99.
Wow.
For the first time. And I remember it was such a shock to me seeing that number. And I stopped singing, and it's, you know, Peter coming out of the boat, you know, as soon as he looked at the waves, he sank. As soon as I stopped singing and started analyzing what was going on, it started to go back down again. And I thought, I'm going to keep singing. And I did. And the more I sang, "It's Your Breath in My Lungs," so I pour out my praise. I pour out my praise. And I don't, you know, there's another verse to that song, and actually, that's not the name of the song. The song is "God is Great" or something like that.
"Great Are You,
and,
Lord."
"Great Are You, Lord." And so, you know, I didn't know that part of the song for some reason, so I just kept singing the part that I knew. And the longer I sang it, the stronger my breathing got. And I remember feeling instantly, God had healed me, and that the breathing, and from that day forward, my breathing stayed in the 90s, and my improvement became rapid. In fact, one of the nurses knows us, knows our family, and she said, "Mayor Brooks, I believe you're right. I believe you've had a miracle." Because every nurse that came in, "Oh, you're breathing so much better." And I said, "Yeah, God healed me. I sang 'It's Your Breath in My Lungs.'" And someone were like, "Well, that's nice." And, you know, would leave. And one of the nurses, Abby, she goes, I believe you have had a miracle." And so that's the song. Got put on social media, and I reached out to those songwriters, and they both responded thanking me for sharing it. The lady, it's a man and a woman who co-wrote the song, and her response was, "I am reading this and weeping." And of course, it in nowhere is close to the weeping that I did, because I realized God had honored our faith and honored my faith of praising him in prison and in that terrible, dark situation. But you have to remember that same psychological wave was still crashing over me, and I was still getting the remdesivir, and I was still getting the donor plasma, and I was still getting the injections, and doubt You know, people make fun of Doubting Thomas, but that's real. You know, you start thinking that thing ticked down one time and I started to doubt. Okay, so did God really heal me? Am I really going to go home? Your lifeline to the outside is my iPad and my iPhone. And I'm reading on Facebook where people are dying. People in the same hospital, in the same hallway that I am. And I knew that they were there. And then I see the report that they had passed away. And then you start feeling the guilt of God saved me, but didn't save them. A pastor younger than I died while I was in the hospital, just up the road towards Knoxville, Tennessee, and Loudoun. And you question, God, why did you save me? So then I started saying, you know, people, you know, praise the Lord, I heard about your miracle, I'm praying for you. And I would instantly respond, please pray that God would show me what he has for me to do. He kept me here for some reason. And so, yeah, that's the song.
That's an amazing story. So with that being said, and I know we're going to run out of time here. I could talk to you forever, I guess. But I do have to ask you this. This just came to my mind. Dostoevsky is one of my favorite authors. Okay, so The Idiot, fantastic book, Crime and Punishment, of course, Brothers Karamazov. And Dostoevsky's story is that he's taken to a Russian prison and then hauled out in front of a firing squad. They blindfold him and raise their rifles and shout. And just before they shout fire, the guards are called away and then the prisoners are taken back to their prison cell. Now, in that moment between the fire and them going back to their prison cell, his life flashed right before his eyes. He said when they took the blindfold off, he said he saw colors that he had never seen before, smelled smells he had never seen before, because he had just experienced what the end of his life was going to look like, a perspective that many people don't have until they come to that. I can't help but wonder if everything that you just experienced has given you kind of a new lease on life.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. There's a picture of Kim and I. They released us from the hospital. I was advised. Of course, you're in quarantine for the first 14 days immediately, but I was advised to go ahead and take another 14 off. Just take a month off. Just for your body, for your recuperation. The hospitalist told me this. My pulmonologist told me this. Everybody said, double pneumonia plus COVID, your body is going to have to recover. And so there's a picture of us sort of mid recovery, and we're on the porch, and it's a sunny day. And you're right. Your perspective is different. And I remember taking that selfie, and it sort of took on a life of its own. We both had our Tenova t-shirts on, thanking the first responders and thanking the frontline workers at Tenova, and that sort of took on a life of its own. But you're right, the very first day, I was released on July the 10th, and July the 11th, all I wanted to do was sit outside on the front porch. And I remember going outside, I was still in my robe and pajamas, and Kim was like, honey, you're the mayor. And, you know, people are driving by and, you know, I'm like, I don't care. I just want to look at the sky. Yeah. And you're right. You have an entirely different perspective of, I almost didn't make it here. And that very same 24 or 48 hour period of me being released was the memorial service for a guy right down the hall, whom I loved dearly. I was in room 107. Another Church of God headquarters employee was in room 108. The minute I was released, they had brought in a recliner to my room. They said, we got to get you out of this bed. And I remember the first day they brought it in, it was like, I think I got put into ICU midnight, Sunday night. So it was like Monday, the week shift came in, and she said, you don't have a recliner in here. We need to get you out of this bed. By Tuesday, she goes, I want you to get up and get out of your bed, at least for your meals. Wednesday is when when I got my healing Thursday and Friday, I never got back in the bed. And I, when they agreed to release me on Friday, which is a whole nother story, I said, I'm not being wheeled out of this hospital. I will walk out of this hospital. It was one of my Ronald Reagan moments. I said, it's important for people to see that the mayor's okay. Yeah. But I said, send this recliner to the guy in 108. I want him to have it because I believe this was part of my recovery, getting up and getting out of that bed. His wife still thanks me. He was a few days past me getting released and said, thank God for your recliner, getting my husband up, getting him out of that bed. And I, of course, say, it's God. It's God's touch on me. It's God's touch on those doctors and nurses, the infection specialist who came up with that, I called it the chemical cocktail of the remdesivir and the donor plasma and the super high dextromethazone steroids, identical to what they gave the president. They were came up with in July at Tenova. Why is our fatality rate so much lower than Hamilton and other counties? Because our infection specialist came up with this same chemical cocktail that is actually keeping our fatality rate low. Do we have cases? Yes. But look at the fatality rates in some of the other cities and counties our size. They're dramatically lower.
Well, I was going to ask you some other questions. I was going to ask you some questions about the election, but by the time this finally airs, I think some of the dust from that will finally settle.
Let's hope.
But there's no doubt that regardless of what you think about Trump, and this is you'll look at this pejoratively, and maybe I don't, but when people hear this, but I don't know what you would think, but he definitely he stirred up some things. Yeah. So and that is not going to go away regardless of what happens with all of this election stuff. So I want to read you something, and then I just kind of want to ask you about your experience with them and what you think the future, and the them is media, mainstream media, what you think the future of the country looks like under the normalcy campaign. Let's just say, assume that Biden takes office and all that stuff. So this, I think, paints the picture of what's going on in the media presently. So this is from The Times, and it says, and you can kind of, I'll try to illustrate this, but it speaks for itself.
LA Times or New York Times?
Sorry, New York Times. Mr. Biden's announcement offered a telling split-screen counterpoint to an event being held at the same time at the White House, a vaccine summit where President Trump boasted about what he called a monumental national achievement. Now, full stop, it's a national achievement. They have a vaccine within 9 months.
It's a global. It's a global achievement.
It's yes, yeah. Well put, because it looks as though places in Europe, England, is going to get this, maybe even before we do, based upon what an American company created. So absolutely, it is a monumental national achievement. So the fact that he's boasting about it, maybe he has a right to. Of course, the Times is probably hinting at the fact that he's just a boaster. And then it goes on, by drug companies to develop a vaccine for the virus in about 9 months. He did not address the growing death toll or the devastation across the country, because we cannot celebrate something that's good ever under Trump. But he used the occasion to suggest yet again, and without evidence, that people had tried to steal the election. Meanwhile, the next administration was clearly taking shape. So it's very obvious, anybody with a brain that reads that, that is one heck of a biased reporter who has a very sour opinion of Trump and very good of Biden. And it's editorialized completely. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Stephen Glass, but I think you'd really love to watch the movie if you haven't seen. Have you seen the movie?
I have not.
You should watch the movie called Shattered Glass with Steve. It's this movie about Stephen Glass, and he got in a ton of trouble for lying. And it passed through his editor, because he was a trusted reporter. And now I think that they've killed every single editor in every single paper across the nation, because editors no longer fact check anything
exactly
anymore.
Right.
It's all opinion, almost entirely. And this is obviously slanted.
Well, it happened to us this week. New York Times was reporting incorrect data and listed Cleveland, Tennessee as the second most pending hotspot. Ironically, Athens, Tennessee. Hmm. Was up there too. And they took data. They took our city population on the back of my business card. City population versus our current active cases is not correct. you have to take the full county. Mm-hmm. We report COVID in Tennessee by county. There is no city count.
Yeah.
So to list Cleveland, Tennessee in the New York Times just this very week. So our county mayor's responded to it. I've responded to it.
I'm sure that response will get printed.
Well, yeah. And again, it's incredibly biased, but I'll make all my Republican friends mad. Trump did not help himself by constantly tweeting out rather unusual things, usually at very odd hours of the night and
totally
morning.
Agree.
And so he allowed the media, you said, New York Times, obviously leaning towards his boastfulness. Had he not been boastful by nature, that editorialization would never have flown.
That's fair.
It would
have
made no sense. And so I constantly asked my friends who had the ability to communicate to President Trump if he would just tone it down. I mean, I have to tell my kids.
Yeah, good luck with that one.
Yeah, you can't do that just because Trump did.
Yeah.
So I think there's enough blame to go around. I wish that he had not been so boastful. But you're right. The New York Times, in printing that article, it is 1,000% totally biased. But even here in Cleveland, that happens. What we have become is a society with really no bounds. There is no longer. Well, what if that is wrong? There used to be. I remember that wonderful movie with Katharine Graham and the Washington Post, and was talking about the Nixon and Tom Hanks was in it, and it was just this wonderful sort of documentary of the Washington Post and Katharine Graham, and they really did. We can't print this until we know it's true.
Yeah,
and that's gone.
Yeah,
Whether it's on your phone or your iPad or however you're receiving your news, you can just scroll down Apple News, and some of the headlines are just crazy. And it's not just here. I see it in Europe and other places, and I wish that we had gone or could go back to a little bit more of a journalism integrity society. I am part of the political realm, and I wish that we had more political integrity.
Sure.
So in the same sense of I wish President Trump had not behaved the way he did on social media, I wished all elected officials would not behave the way they do on social media.
Yeah.
You know, part of the whole Nashville, when I was declared a moderate because I was friends with the governor, which is not a bad thing. I think it's kind of what we're supposed to do is reach across the aisle and,
you would think, yeah,
and make friends. You know, we actually had Republicans going after Republicans. It was crazy. It was self-inflicted gunshot wounds in our own party. And so that's a whole nother podcast for a whole nother day.
Sure.
It's, you know, it's part of our systemic problem. Our systems are broken. We are all human. We are all flawed, but we have allowed so much to go so low. My son is now 28. So many, many years ago, I was waiting in the car line at Cleveland Middle School, and the headline on the radio, not the iPhone back then, this was 2006, maybe five, was Britney Spears' baby sister was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really almost joyful. And I remember waiting in line for my middle school son to come out, and this headline came across the radio. And by the time my son got to the car, I was in tears. I had turned off the radio, and Zach was like, "Dad, what in the world?" And I was like, "Buddy, I'm just so sorry for the world you're going to have to live in. You're not even a teenager yet. You haven't even begun the development that you're going to go through. And the world is already in such a terrible state that we're thrilled that a very young teenage girl is having a child out of wedlock." And I said, "You know, I'm praying for you, son." And that was, again, a lifetime ago.
Mm-hmm.
and it's not gotten any better. And so I was thrilled when I was given the chance to come back home and try to make my hometown a better place. Hmm. And that's for the kids. That's for the elderly. That's for all communities of all races. Cleveland is incredibly diverse, far more diverse than people realize. Very large Latino population, exploding Ukrainian population. Yeah, there's just so many subgroups within our small town. The church has a lot to do with it. A very global international. When the tornadoes hit in Easter, I was thrilled at the Ukrainian churches on the east side of Cleveland that enveloped into their neighborhoods with this incredible giving back to the neighbors that gave them so much, gave them a chance when they first came to America. And I was like, this is Cleveland.
That's awesome.
This is what Cleveland's all about.
Well, at least in this conversation, I have been Rip Van Winkle and now you. So I've decried the degradation of our media, and then you've decried the degradation of morality in America. So what do you think? I mean, just in a word, do you think that Trump has unlocked a Pandora's box that we will never come back from? I'll be honest and tell you what I think about the return to normalcy campaign under the Biden administration. I don't buy it. I think that it's hush money that their candidate won. And so now it's easy for them to say, well, now it's time for unity. We'll see what happens. But and I don't want to be divisive. All I'm saying is that I wonder about the future of our nation if... and maybe there's a positive way to look at this. So you can help us end on a positive note. What do you think is the future of partisanship, politics, maybe media, and if you can comprise those all into one thing?
You know, I think, you know, we mentioned it a moment ago about the pendulum shift and far right, far left. I think it is becoming even more polarized. I think that's what we're going to see. I don't believe the new normalcy campaign either. I think it's going to be even more polarized, the differences between working Americans and the elite Americans that are really right now controlling the process. I've had so many people ask me, you know, about the election, about the outcome, about the current court cases. And, you know, well, who do you think wins? And I've sort of fine-tuned my answer. And I'll give it to you. I think the Constitution wins. And I think that's what we've gotten off the focus of.
That's good.
I'm not going to name which man or woman wins the election. I think this election is proving that the Constitution wins.
Wow.
And do I like every outcome of every election? No, of course not. I've lost elections. I've had outcomes where I did not like it personally. So I get it. But the Electoral College appears to be working. I do think the legitimacy and the integrity of voter voting and voter machines, and I think that's going to be looked at very closely. We have become too reliant on our electronics. You know, throw your iPhone out the car window and see how long it takes you to turn around and go back and get it. We've become, myself included. My Wi-Fi goes down, first world problems, and I can't get my provider on the phone fast enough, you know, because smart house and all my devices and all these other things. And so I think we've become too reliant on that. But I think in the end, our founding fathers wrote a document that protects and predicts similar to what we're in right now. And we've got to focus on that. And can we come back from this? Of course we can. Is there going to be tomorrow? Of course there will be. Will there be normalcy? I'm not sure if we know what the definition of normal is any longer. And is your normal the same as my normal?
No.
So I think you're right. I think they're going to throw a bunch of money at a bunch of people, and you know, everybody's going to get another stimulus check. I pray we don't have a national lockdown. I pray we don't have national nonsense that will do such detrimental harm to our systems and to our citizens.
Yeah.
I really worry about the working moms, the single moms. I worry about the seven-year-old girls in Candy's Creek Cherokee Elementary School who don't understand why they can't be with their friends and the pressure of learning online when they've never done it before. I hear reports of moms lamenting that my child sits in front of her computer and weeps because she's so confused.
Yeah.
Breaks my heart.
Yeah. I love that response because I think that we can say a lot about this election. And of course, the news media is going to capitalize on Trump as long as they possibly can before he leaves office. About whether it's ridiculous for Republicans to make this accusation or whether the left is sweeping things under the rug too quickly or just wanting to move on or whatever needs to be said about that. But I think the one thing that we should be able to agree on, left, right, center, is that our Constitution is being tested right now.
Mm-hmm.
And look what's happening. Is that it's proving itself again to us in this generation.
Yeah.
My hope is that people will realize that the fact that we can question an election is a good thing. Because, by the way, that doesn't happen in some countries. You get killed when
That's
you question elections.
True.
And I'm not saying like we should be thankful for what we got. What I'm saying is that we have one heck of a great country and one heck of a durable constitution.
Yeah.
So I'd put it this way. I think freedom is fragile, not because it's weak, but because it's precious. And it can be broken, and it needs to be protected. But I think our Constitution is durable. I think it is showing itself again to be a durable document that can help us through even a situation like what we're going through.
Well said.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being here. Fascinating conversation. Look forward to having you hopefully in the future again.
I look forward to being back. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye, everybody. Our thanks again to our guests for being on the show today. Indie Thinker with Reed Uberman was brought to you by our sponsors. If you like what you heard today, please do us a big favor and give it a 5-star review and like it and share it with friends. And if you want to hear more awesome guests, make sure to check out past episodes. IndieThinker is a nonprofit paid for by our sponsors and the generous gifts of people like you. In order to hear more great guests like you did today, please consider giving a tax-deductible gift by going to IndieThinker.org. And just remember, your voice matters, but infinitely more when you think for yourself.